Hi, I'm Molly Wonsall.
And I'm Geoffrey Wonsall.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we've been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
Which is what prompted us to start this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsall and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wonsall.
Welcome back everyone, thank you so much for listening. And Molly and I hope that you continue to enjoy these rather dark tales.
Yeah, I hope so. We've got a really nice email this week from a really nice person in America.
Yes, I was very touched.
Hold on, I'm going to find it because it was really... can't tell you how much it means to us when we get these emails.
Yeah, especially from America.
Crikey. Yes, can you believe it?
Absolutely extraordinary.
Can you believe we've reached across the pond? It's from Hope Butcher.
Yes.
She's from Virginia. And she listened to it with her mum and with her son.
Family values.
How about that? Well, we're all family values. That's our USP, Dad.
That's it.
That we're...
This is a family show done by a family.
With very unfamiliar topics.
Well, I've been filming again this week, another series of Murder by the Sea, with my friends at Monster Films for CBS Reality, which is incidentally, the first 18 episodes are replaying.
As we speak.
Very almost. Soon. Very soon.
Very soon. No, they haven't started yet.
No, I think
they're rerunning the whole series.
Next week, yeah.
So Geoffrey's done more murder this week. He's got almost no voice left, and we're going to make him record more podcasts.
No, I've been keeping it as calm as I possibly can and taking lots of honey and lemon.
Looking after the vocal cords.
And it's fine. It's just I've noticed it's gone down a bit.
Oh, the level. You've got deeper.
Got slightly deeper.
Oh, do you know that I saw what good news I saw, and I can download it for you onto your computer when you go away. The new series of the Kosminski Method's coming out 25th of October.
Wonderful, wonderful.
You like that show. Oh, you'll already be away.
Yeah, I'll be away.
Will you be able to get it on your Netflix?
Yes, I'll get it on the Netflix on this one.
Wi-Fi in...
In the Sahara, yeah. Yes. Believe it or not, they do have Wi-Fi in the Sahara.
I do believe it.
That's unlikely, good. Though that may
that's
sound.
Good news, isn't it, Dad? You like that show?
Yeah, I do, very much so. Now, we have some interesting news.
We've got some news. We are going to do a live show.
No sniggering in the back, thank you.
Because we thought that would be really fun. We're recording a couple more podcasts and then we're going to have a bit of a break. You get them a bit later than we do them, so it won't be too much of a break. But we're going to do a live podcast. We're going to record it. It's going to be a Christmas special. Should we say what it's about yet? No. We'll keep the details, but it's going to be a double bill, a special, pretty famous one. It's going to be a big one. And we are hoping to do that on the 8th of December, which is a Sunday, at about 6, I think. Obviously, more specific details to follow. As usual, we're, you know, winging it. And it should be taking place at Oxford House, which is in Bethnal Green, which is a...
East London.
There. Yeah.
Yeah, very look forward to it. We hope an audience, we hope we get a...
We've got 120 seats to fill.
Crikey. Well, let's hope we get 120 people there.
That'll I really... One. Oh, we're in trouble if not. Geoffrey and I are hoping to, if not, to corral all of our friends.
Yes.
Oh, and you know what I've asked, Poppy suggested cleverly, and our Dan, my brother Dan, said he'll come and play the music live.
Well,
so it really will be a family affair.
Couldn't be better.
Wouldn't that be nice? And I was thinking yesterday as well when I was listening to our... recently podcast where we talked about Betsy, and I put a picture of Betsy, how she's laid now in her basket, and I thought we'll also have to have Betsy on stage with us.
Absolutely.
Otherwise it wouldn't be...
No, it wouldn't be
a real thing.
But it will be a good one. It will be a well-known case, very well-known actually, arguably one of the best known of all murder cases in Britain.
In a location appropriate
in a location
venue.
Entirely appropriate to the venue. And it will be recorded in front of an audience. And we hope we might get the odd question or two from the audience, which would be very nice.
It would be very jolly, wouldn't it? Anyway, we think that would be frightfully fun.
So, that's a bit of news. But today, we have one of the most controversial cases of recent years, which at the time created a positive stir.
So today we're doing James Hanratty.
Also known famously as the A6 murderer.
The A6 murderer, here we go.
James Hanratty was the eldest of four sons of James and Mary. He was born in Kent. Some people say Bromley. We're not absolutely sure. On the 4th of October, 1936. The family moved to Wembley in North London quite soon after his birth. Hanratty was a troubled child. He was certainly mentally challenged. He wasn't as mentally challenged as, say, Timothy Evans was in the 10 Willington Place murders, but he was certainly difficult. He was certainly also described as a pathological liar. But his parents were very protective of him, and they insisted that he shouldn't be sent away to a special school, that he was, should be left in the ordinary educational system. And he left school at 15, almost totally illiterate. He could barely read and certainly couldn't write. And in July 1952, at the age of 16, he had one of those events which we've become so used to when we talk about killers. He fell off his bicycle.
And hit his head.
And was unconscious for 10 hours.
Unconscious for 10 hours?
Yes. Now, we've talked before about the impact of head injuries on...
traumatic incidents.
On young men who turn into killers. But this is yet another anecdotal evidence, yet more anecdotal evidence, that it may have some impact. We can't be sure, but it certainly shouldn't be ignored. After leaving hospital, Hanratty moved to Brighton, where 8 weeks later he was found collapsed in the street. He had a brain operation because of a mistaken diagnosis of a brain hemorrhage. So you could say that Hanratty was a truly...
That wouldn't happen now.
No, it wouldn't. Troubled young man. He had no real empathy with his family, and so after this collapse in Brighton, which saw him taken to hospital and the brain operation, he was sent to live with his aunt in Bedford to recuperate. He liked his aunt, and he and his brother Michael quite often went to stay with her. But I'm afraid all that happened was it sent Hanratty off on what could best be described as a life of crime. In September 1954, at the age of 17, he was put on probation for driving without a licence and incidentally offered psychiatric treatment. In October 1955, at 18, he was given 2 years imprisonment for housebreaking and theft. He slashed his wrists in prison and was described as a potential psychopath. In July 1957, at the age of 20, only 5 months after leaving Wormwood Scrubs, he was given 6 months for motoring offences and again called a psychopath. In March 1958, at 21, he was sentenced to 3 years for car theft and was described as having gross social and emotional immaturity. He made 2 failed attempts to escape. In March 1961, at the age of 24, he's released. 5 months later, he becomes the subject of a major murder inquiry. If you look at pictures of Hanratty, which I encourage you to do, he has a rather open face.
And have a look now.
Very, almost naive. And it was the way he looked, plus this history of hitting his head and a brain hemorrhage, and that led to partly to those people who believed that he was not guilty of the crime for which he was convicted.
Sort of quite a square face.
Yes. A square. He doesn't look, like the devil incarnate.
Yeah, no, but what does evil look like, Dan?
Well, no, we've talked about that many times. You never tell. Some of the most horrific deeds are committed by people who look positively peaceful. Anyway, to the crime itself. On the evening of Tuesday, the 22nd of August, 1961, Valerie Story is sitting beside her lover, Michael Gregston, in the front of a grey Morris Minor four-door. 847BHN was its number plate.
Very specific.
Gregston was a scientist at the Road Research Laboratory in Slough, and Story was his assistant. They'd been having an affair for some time. He'd separated from his wife and two children. He was 36 and she was 22 and living with her parents near Slough. The car was parked in a cornfield near Dorney Reach in Buckinghamshire. Well, I don't think I need to draw you a picture of what might have or might not have been going on in the car parked in the cornfield. And this, it does become genuinely chilling. A man knocked on the driver's door window. And when Gregston wound down the window, he shoved a .38 revolver through it and said, and I quote, "This is a hold-up. I'm a desperate man. I have been on the run for 4 months. If you do as I tell you, you will be all right." And he said it in a Cockney accent. It should be said at once that Hanratty did have a Cockney accent.
I wish you'd done a Cockney accent there, Dan.
Not going to do that anymore. I'm not doing impressions. Gregston was then made to drive round for hours. Literally, Hanratty, or whoever the man with the gun was, forced Gregston to drive round and round all through Buckinghamshire and Bedfordshire until finally he got him to stop in a lay-by on the A6 in Bedfordshire, which was prophetically called Dead Man's Hill. Dead Man's Hill. At first, Gregson refused to stop, and the man said, "Well, I want to sleep." So, here it becomes even more bizarre. He ties Valerie Story's hands behind her back with Gregston's tie, but when Gregston moved too quickly, perhaps the man thought something was going to happen, the man with the gun, the man shot him twice in the head, killing him instantly. A fight breaks out with Story. But the man, eventually, obviously stronger than she was, this is a 22-year-old woman, he forces her into the back of the car and rapes her after he's forced her to take her underclothes off. Story is then told by the man to drag Gregson's body out of the front seat of the car by the lay-by. And she goes to sit with Gregston. Story was clearly terrified for her life. She'd been raped. She didn't know what this madman was capable of. He'd killed her lover. When all of a sudden, the man fires 7 shots at her, 5 of which hit her. He even reloads the revolver. She feigned death. She was brutally, mortally injured. In fact, she was paralysed from the neck down by the shots. And the man drove away in the Morris Minor. At 6:45 a.m. on the morning of Wednesday, the August the 23rd, 1961, Gregson's body was found, and so was Story.
That's horrible.
It was a horrible, horrible killing. Story told the police before the operation, which she inevitably had to see if they could save her, that the man had been dressed in a 3-piece suit and had polished shoes. Now the story becomes even more bizarre. On the evening of Thursday the 24th, the day after the discovery of Gregson, a gun was found, loaded and wiped down, wrapped in a handkerchief, under the back seat of a number 36A London bus. It was the gun that had killed Gregson and shot Valerie Story. It was established. One man was picked up on suspicion at this point, but we'll come back to that. On the 11th of September, two cartridge cases were found in the basement bedroom of the Vienna Hotel in St. John's Wood in London. They matched the bullets in Gregston, the bullet fired at Valerie Story, and the gun on the 36A bus. The room was registered to a man calling himself James Ryan, who eventually was identified as none other than James Hanratty. On the 11th of October, Hanratty was arrested in Blackpool, and on the 14th, Valerie Story identified him as the man who attacked her and killed Gregston and shot her. On the surface, it was an absolutely open and shut case. James Hanratty went to trial at the Bedfordshire Assizes very quickly. In those days, it didn't take so long for a murder trial to come before a jury. On the 22nd of January 1962. Now things become distinctly complicated. When Hanratty launches his defence, he tells the court that he was in Liverpool that night, Tuesday, August the 22nd. But then, halfway through, he says, no, I was actually in Rhyl.
In Wales.
In North Wales. Okay. Now, I can't but believe that that had an impact on the jury. It would be also be fair to say that Hanratty wasn't exactly a convincing witness in his own defence. He admitted, for example, that he tried to obtain a gun after his release from jail in March 1961. It was a vicious killing and a dreadful rape, and Story had paid an extraordinary price for her life. But there was no forensic evidence.
It's ballistics.
Well, the gun on the bus and the two cartridge cases in the Vienna Hotel matched
the bullets.
And it was pretty clear that Hanratty was familiar with the 36A bus, but it was still circumstantial evidence. The jury retired and eventually returned a unanimous verdict of guilty. As was the custom in those days, the judge placed a black silk square on his head and sentenced Hanratty to death. Hanratty was hanged in Bedford Prison on the 4th of April 1962. He was just 25. He was one of the final 8 executions in Britain before the death penalty was abandoned. And almost no sooner had Hanratty been hanged than a vast public campaign was launched. Partly, of course, because at that point there was a great campaign to see the death penalty ended in this country. And indeed, it was ended. But Hanratty was, like Timothy Evans, one of those people whom everybody thought had gone to the gallows unfairly. A great campaign was launched. Paul Foote, the investigative journalist, Private Eye, Fenner Brockway, the Labour MP, Joan Lester. There was a great Hanratty was falsely killed campaign. And indeed, there were no fewer than 3 independent police inquiries into the case. One in March 1967, one in April 1975, and one in May 1996. In particular, those investigations focused on a man called Peter Alphon. Now, Peter Alphon, like Hanratty, was known to the police. He had a record of criminal behaviour and had, well, looked remarkably similar. In fact, he looked more similar to the E-fit, or in those days, of course, it was a drawing that Valerie Story had given, than Hanratty did.
Should I look it up?
No, that's fine, darling. It wasn't absolutely true, but there was a considerable feeling that, this was all very iffy. It was suggested, for example, that Alphon had been paid by Michael Gregston's wife to kill him as a result of the affair with Valerie Story. Alphon is a controversial figure.
Was he arrested and questioned then?
Yes, he was.
Must have been a big plea to try and get his name cleared, because when I just googled James Hanratty and looked at pictures, there was a picture of John Lennon and Yoko Ono with James Hanratty's parents.
Yes, well, it was an enormous campaign to clear Hanratty. I mean, it had been discovered, for example, that a large sum of money had been paid into Alphon's account from a mysterious source.
HelloFresh is the UK's leading recipe box service, delivering fresh, pre-proportioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your door. It's the easy, convenient way to cook delicious dinners from scratch every time. Choose your favourites from 19 recipes a week, including rapid recipes, ready in 20 minutes or less, family favourites, British and world cuisine, and even a lower calorie balance range. And because all their fresh ingredients come from their suppliers, pre-portioned for you, there's no food waste. Hey Dad, I wanted to tell you about HelloFresh. It's this recipe box service that I've tried. They deliver food to your door, you choose the recipes you want, and then everything comes pre-portioned with a recipe card, and you make it yourself. I found it really brilliant because I work such long hours and they provide a special set of recipes which you can cook in under 20 minutes. So when I get home from work, I can make myself a delicious meal and still have an evening, which, as you know, isn't always easy.
I do know that, darling.
And the great news is that HelloFresh are offering our listeners £60 off 4 boxes. All you've got to do is visit hellofresh.co.uk and enter the code BLOODTIES when you check out. So you should definitely give it a go.
Oh, I'm going to give it a go. It's got so many benefits. I mean, I gather it has a flexible subscription with no minimum term, so you can change your delivery day and skip weeks to suit yourself. I think it sounds like a terrific idea. You can choose a range of cuisines. As you say, there are recipes to cook in 20 minutes, but they also do family-friendly recipes, world cuisine, something to suit everyone.
Yeah, and did you know on average a household has 6 recipes that they stick to? HelloFresh can help you get out of that cooking rut by giving you 19 different recipes to choose from a week.
So, as you say, it's great news. HelloFresh are offering our listeners £60 off 4 boxes. Just go to hellofresh.co.uk and enter BLOODTIES when you check out to enjoy really delicious dinners without the drama. Gregston, according to Alphon, was given 2 opportunities to escape. Well, all that's important really is that Alphon, when he was stressed, lapsed into Cockney. He never produced a convincing alibi. He was a poor driver. And one of the pieces of evidence that Valerie Story gave to the police is when the man drove off in the Morris Minor that they'd been in, he drove very badly. Hanratty, of course, had track record of motoring offences, and he was certainly a good driver. And Paul Foote, the investigative journalist, obtained a copy of Alphon's bank account showing that he'd received payments in cash totalling £7,569 between October 1961 and June 1962. The third police inquiry in 1996, led by Detective Chief Superintendent Roger Matthews, reported to the Home Secretary, the then Home Secretary, Michael Howard, suggesting, not confirming, suggesting that Hanratty may have been innocent. And in March 1997, shortly before Labour's victory in the election, the Home Office referred Hanratty's case to the newly created Criminal Cases Review Commission, where some of the original evidence had been destroyed. There was still a DNA sample from Valerie Story's underwear. There was also DNA found on the handkerchief that wrapped the gun. Because, of course, it was a long time after 1961.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we have a lot of very sophisticated...
Very different and very sophisticated
forensics. In the end, the case came back to the Court of Appeal, and it included a discussion of the handling of the various items of evidence involved. In fact, Hanratty was exhumed so that his DNA could be taken. Yeah.
That's a bit much. I suppose not, if you're trying to clear someone's name.
Yeah, you know, it was important. The DNA was also donated by both Hanratty's mother and his brother. At the original tests, the DNA was said to be 2.5 million times more likely to belong to James Hanratty than to anyone else. And the Court of Appeal didn't have the power to order the exhumation, but the Lord Chief Justice, then Lord Chief Justice Wolfe, decided it was desirable in the interests of justice. The case comes back to the Court of Appeal in 2002. Exhumation was in 2001. And the decision of the Court of Appeal was absolutely clear. The modern testing of DNA from Hanratty's corpse and the members of his family convinced the Court of Appeal that Hanratty's guilt was proved beyond doubt. And they went on to say, the DNA evidence doesn't stand alone, and the court refers to some of the more striking coincidences in the light of the DNA. If James Hanratty was not guilty, he would have been wrongly identified by three witnesses at identification parades. First, as the person at the scene of the crime, and secondly, by two witnesses driving a vehicle close to where the vehicle in which the murder was committed was found. He had the same identifying manner of speech as the killer. He stayed in a room the night before the crime, which the bullets had been fired from the murder weapon were found. The murder weapon was recovered from a place on a bus, which he regarded as a hiding place, and the bus followed a route he could well have used. His DNA was found on a piece of material from Valerie Story's knickers, where it would be expected to be if he was guilty. It was also found on the handkerchief with the gun. And they concluded, this number of alleged coincidences mean that they are not coincidences. Not coincidences at all, but provide overwhelming proof of the safety of the conviction from an evidential perspective. At that point, the campaign to prove Hanratty's innocence pretty much collapsed. Ludovic Kennedy changed his mind, although Michael Mansfield, arguing for Hanratty at the appeal, argued that there could have been contamination. It wasn't an argument that convinced the court. The family and some of the supporters continued to contest the conclusion and press for further reviews. Valerie Story said, in the wake of the Court of Appeal, I identified the guilty man. I looked in his eyes and he looked in mine. I knew who he was and he knew that I recognised him. I had found the guilty man.
What do you think, Dad?
Valerie Story. died on the 26th of March 2016 in the house in which she'd been born. She'd been an invalid her entire life. I am absolutely convinced that the Court of Appeal was right. I think Hanratty might have been unlucky that he wasn't better defended at his original trial at Bedford Assizes. But I think on the balance of probabilities, and certainly on the balance of the new, more recent DNA evidence, Hanratty was guilty. Now, you can then argue, of course, as we have done many times, should Hanratty have faced the gallows?
No, well, you don't believe in the death penalty anyway.
Well, I don't, but I am... You know, anyone who condemns a 22-year-old young woman to spend the rest of her life paralysed, it's difficult to be very sympathetic. And as for Gregston's family, they were heartbroken. He had two young children. It is a very, very famous and controversial case. There are still some who believe that it was actually Peter Alphon and that it wasn't Hanratty. But I think the DNA pretty much puts pay to that. They have tried to reopen the case a couple of times, but it's now a very long time ago.
Best left now.
I think probably, yes. We're nearly 60 years ago. But it is possible for justice to be blind, as the statue above the Old Bailey is, with the scales in one hand and a sword in the other. Might Hanratty have been got off? It's possible.
He just shouldn't have been put to death. That's yes. Probably the issue.
I've recently been doing a famous case called the Brighton Trunk Murders, in which a formidable defence barrister, Norman Burkitt, QC, got the killer, Tony Mancini, off. It took place in 1934. Mm. Had Mancini been found guilty, he would have been hanged. And in 1976, at the end of Mancini's life, he admitted he'd committed the crime to a News of the World reporter.
God, how odd.
40 years later.
What, you could live with that your whole life and then just before you die, like, oh, just let everyone know.
There was a discussion about whether or not Mancini should be prosecuted for perjury, but he wasn't. But we are in that very interesting moral area. We don't quite know. If you'd been on the jury, what would you... I mean, it would depend what you, the evidence you saw before you, wouldn't it?
And also, though, when we were talking, when we did Dr. Crippen the other day.
Yep.
That was the same. Like, that was more circumstantial.
Yes.
And he got put to death.
He did indeed.
It was just a different time.
Yes, it certainly was. But that is the story of the A6 murder.
Thank you. That's really interesting. I didn't really know that much about Hanratty.
No, it's very much it was one of the things, one of the cumulative pieces of evidence or propaganda that led to the eventual suspension of the death penalty.
Is the character in 39 Steps called Hanratty?
No.
What's he called?
Hang on. I'll remember in a minute.
It sounds like that, doesn't it?
Yes. My mind.
39 Steps is a film.
It's a book written by John Buchan.
Sorry, it's a book now and adapted into a film. Yeah. And a stage show.
And it's been made a film three times.
It was directed, the one I'm thinking of, in 1935 by Alfred Hitchcock.
It was indeed.
Starring Robert Donat. And Madeline Carroll.
Yes.
And what are the names of the characters? I ask. Richard Hannay.
Yes. Close but not quite. Well, so that is the case of James Hanratty.
That's lovely. Thanks, Dad. All right. Splendid.
What are you doing then? Let's talk about something more cheerful. I seem to have spent an awful lot of this week talking about death. And most of next week as well, when it comes to that.
I'm not talking about death. I am just doing my job in a normal way. I'm not going to anything. And then I'm going to Los Angeles.
For an opening.
For a premiere.
Premiere. And then you're coming back and then you're going to Los Angeles again.
Yes, that is correct.
Well, I've spent a lot of time in aeroplanes.
Yes, sir. Getting sick, probably.
Well.
Yes, so that's that, really. But I'm not there very long. I land on Saturday and I fly back on Tuesday.
Yes, I've done that a few times.
And then I come back and then the day I get back, I've got to go to a press night in Hampstead. Actually, it's the next day.
Crikey. Well, crikey. I can remember doing it.
I'm looking forward to the Christmas holidays, basically.
Yeah, I thought that was very wise. but it's in a very good cause. You know, it's all grist to the professional
grist
mill.
Grist to the mill. Exactly. All right, super.
Should we thank people again?
Yes.
You think?
Oh, sorry. Every time. We should thank everyone always. Thank you very much to Audio Boom for hosting us. Thank you to Poppy Damon, our producer, and my brother Dan for doing the music, and my friend George, who drew our caricature, and my friend and colleague Hannah, who helps me with all things podcast. And thank you to you, Jeffrey, for doing all the hard work, even though you're exhausted.
No, I'm not exhausted. I've just got... My neck gets rather sore. And it's also... This is, in many ways, easier than filming because I can actually consult things. When I'm filming, I can't look down. Right, I can't look away. Right. I've got to look straight at the lens all the time. It's an effort of memory and as well as an effort of accuracy. So it's this is comparatively easier.
Okay. Well, you get to sit down.
Yeah, I get to sit down now.
Oh, in filming?
In filming. I only have to stand up for four elements, but I get to sit down
the rest of the
time.
They've given you more chairs, more,
yeah,
more
but,
seats.
It's tremendous fun, great privilege to do it. And it's a fascinating subject which continually serves to remind me of what I say at the end of each of these podcasts. Do be careful out there.